The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good Friday morning to you all from the Space Show headquarters in San Rafael, California. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in for this Friday morning. I have a great show planned for you today, and I know you'll find it most interesting. A couple of quick announcements, but one I want to give you up front is that we are going to do an on-time ending at 90 minutes. So if you have questions for our guest, John Strickland, please pace yourself to get them in time for John to respond to you, because you can't send them in, you know, when the show's ending and then expect that we're going to be able to process that today. So please pay attention to that. And then for any of you out there still experiencing iPhone podcast issues, we have figured out that this is most likely due to the Apple podcast app and operating system iOS 9. And these arguments and problems are well documented if you just do a Google search. So on the Space Show announcement blog, I have talked about this, and I've listed the solution that seems to be working for everybody, and that is, even though you may like the Apple podcast app and it may be working fine for you on other podcasts, the app that is recommended across the board for iPhones is Overcast, and it's free, and it's a 5-star app, and it works perfectly with Space Show and other podcasts. So if you are still having an iPhone issue with the podcast, you might download the Overcast app and see how you like it. And I know that's probably not the answer you would like, but iOS 9 has known glitches, including Outlook and email glitches, where it reports bogus unread email. There is not yet a fix for that. But Apple is aware of these problems, and maybe someday they'll decide to fix them when they quit fighting with the FBI, I guess. I don't know. But Overcast is a great Apple app, and it's free. It's 5-star, and it gets the best rating on reviews of how to do podcasts with an Apple product. So just thought I would throw that out there for you. And those of you who would like to call the show today and talk to John Strickland, it is 1-866-687-7223, and email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our website is thespaceshow.com, so don't forget we have the new website newsletter. We have the right sidebar menu for recent shows as well as upcoming shows. As soon as a program hits up in upcoming shows, you can start posting comments on that show's blog space, so to speak. And you can post comments during a live show, and I will get those comments and can read them on air, just as I would an email from you. And then, of course, when the show is archived, that is where you post your comments for the archive programs. It's now live, and it tracks with our live broadcast on the website. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website, or you can easily listen to the archives, whichever way seems to be working for you, and it doesn't take very long to download one of our programs. We are archiving with a smaller file size, so all of that should be a lot faster than it was last year with the older website. We still have our store, and you'll find it on the upper menu, Space Show Gear, so do check it out. We have some items there that hopefully you'll be interested in. And remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with one GiantLeapFoundation.org, and your support keeps us on the air. Without your support, we go bye-bye. except we won't get put into a museum like the space shuttle. So do support us. Remember, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you do get a deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, we are a California Public Benefit Corporation, and you do get a tax deduction for your space shuttle gift as well. If you have any questions, check us out at onegiantleapfoundation.org or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. Everybody has permission to share our show and even pass them around on the net, although it is much easier to send people the URL for our show. If you do this, there are a few simple rules. So number one is nothing commercial with any of our shows, please. Number two, no cut-its or edits and putting them up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And number three, no written transcripts are permitted, even if they're for your own use. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every spaceshow.com website page, and the same for onegiantleapfoundation.org website pages. So again, if you have any questions, you want to get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And sponsors, we have new sponsors as a result of our website campaign from last year. So the first segment of today's show is brought to you by two sponsors, Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and is the partner that you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Also by AIAA, which is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, which is the world's largest aerospace professional society. And they have more than 30,000 engineers and scientists from 88 countries dedicated to the global aerospace profession. AIAA convenes 5 yearly forums or conferences to most of us. They publish books, technical journals, and the Aerospace America magazine. And by the way, I get a lot of space show guests from Aerospace America magazine articles. They host a collection of 150,000 technical papers, develop and maintain standards, honors, and celebrate achievement, and they advocate on space policy issues. They serve aerospace professionals around the world. They help shape the future of aerospace by providing tools, insights, and collaborative exchanges to advance the state of art in engineering and science for both aviation, space, as well as defense. AIAA members make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous, and many, many are bona fide space cadets like most of us listening to this show. Check them out at their website, AIAA.org. And that brings me to today's program, because I'm very happy to bring back John Strickland. We're going to be talking about going to Mars and what it would take to really put together a settlement on Mars. John has been an active member of space and science-related organizations since 1961. And that's when he joined the American Rocket Society as a student member. In 1976, he joined both the National Space Institute and the L5 Society, and those organizations were the parents of National Space Society. He was the founder of the Austin Space Frontier Society and has been chairman since 81 to the present. His full bio is on the website, and it'll take too long to read it, but he is very prolific in the space industry and in the commercial space industry with National Space Society and other organizations. He has numerous online publications which may interest you. They're listed in his bio on the website, which I urge you to check out. But I'd rather talk to John than read about him. So welcome back to the Space Show, John. How are you?
Oh, good. Doing great.
So going to Mars and what it would take to do a settlement on Mars. Where do you want to start? Is our technology readiness level today capable of handling any of this?
Well, if you talk about right now, of course, you can't really send anything bigger than about 1 ton to Mars because of what was perceived about almost 8 to 10 years ago now is the entry, descent, and landing problem. And, of course, with the work of people such as those, the teams at Georgia Tech and other institutions, the problem has turned into a solution. So the problem was basically that you can slow down pretty good using Mars as an air brake, but the air is so thin that parachutes really don't work unless they're the size of the Rose Bowl for a manned spacecraft, which is it's simply not physically possible to deploy a parachute the size of the Rose Bowl. Plus, it probably weighs more than the spacecraft. So you had they just insisted on using the old-fashioned parachutes for the larger vehicles. They tried to scale it up. Well, some things don't scale very well, because the larger your vehicle gets, the heavier it tends to be compared to its size, because of the cube ratio compared to the square ratio. And as a result, you need a bigger and bigger chute, and it doesn't work. So during the previous decade, they started working a thing called supersonic retropropulsion. All that simply means is you're firing your rocket forwards in the same direction you're going. Normally, most rockets fire in the opposite direction to the one they're going in, but you're going to slow down because the air is so thin that if you don't use the rockets to slow down, you're going to go splat, and you're going to end up in lots of little pieces spread all over the Mars landscape, which is not what you want. So the supersonic retropropulsion, or SRP, has been demonstrated already, even with videos showing the Falcon rockets decelerating and showing that the passive drag is not destroyed by the use of the supersonic retropropulsion thrusting, but is enhanced by it. So you're still getting whatever residual passive drag that you get as you're going slower and slower, plus you're getting the deceleration provided by the rockets, and then you just continue to fire the rockets as you come down and do a vertical landing. And, of course, we have now demonstrated several vertical landings on the Earth, which has more than twice the gravity of Mars. So, you know, I think that's pretty well established now.
I have the guys that are the brains behind supersonic retropropulsion coming on the show shortly, and I have their paper that they recently delivered.
Now, which team?
Bobby Braun is.
Oh yeah, Dr. Braun is one of the strongest proponents. I think there's a Dr. Manning.
No, wait, Robert Manning is coming on the show.
Robert Manning. Okay.
Yeah,
he and the other people were early recognizers of the problem, and then figured out how to turn it into a solution. Because yes, as you do the prop, if your vehicle is large enough, physically large enough and wide enough, it can act as its own air brake and get rid of like 3/4 of its velocity as it enters either from orbit or from interplanetary velocity, depending on how you're going to do it. And for a manned landing, you're going to go probably going to orbit first. So that's a little more complicated.
But you know, they don't, they're both signed on to the paper I've read. They don't consider this a done deal by any means and claim that this is theory and there's an enormous amount of testing to be done to see if this could really work. So I would not say it's solved, but I would say it may be potentially solved if they can make all of this work with the kinds of payloads that they would need to get to Mars.
Well, since we now have the video of the Falcon rocket entry, we can actually see the entry plume when the rockets aren't firing, and the rockets are firing, and they can't the rocket engines out at an angle, and which creates a wider zone of a reentry plume, which actually enhances the what we know as passive drag, the actual friction with the air as the vehicle's entering when there's no rocket thrust, and then when the rocket starts to thrust, it's slowing the vehicle down, plus the air drag is slowing the vehicle down at the same time. In the first things they tried, when they tried firing the rocket straight back along the path, along the forward path of the rocket, it pushes the air out of the way, so you get less drag. That's not what you want. And besides that, your exhaust might be blown right back against the base of your vehicle. So You angle the rocket engines out at it, say 20 degrees or more, and it works really good. So we actually have pretty good proof. Plus, we have a lot of, you know, aerodynamic simulations and a little bit of wind tunnel testing. But we've never done physical tests with models that are specifically intended to do landings, you know, and where the atmosphere is thin all the way down to the surface. But I think at least half of it is already proved.
Well, hopefully you can listen live, and if not on archives, and hear what he has to say. I'm really anxious for that program. I forget exactly when he's coming on, but
Make sure you bring up the issue of SRP, because that is a critical issue. You cannot land on Mars with a heavy manned spacecraft unless you use SRP at the moment. It is possible, however, to reduce your fuel consumption during the final landing by figuring out a way to temporarily expand the diameter of your lander vehicle. And there are several different ways to do that. This aerodynamic decelerator is made out of flexible material, which expands in a big sort of a big ring. But the current versions are for one use only. If they could make that reusable, then that would be great. The other method would be a series of pedal-like flaps, which would fold open, that would normally be against the side of a conical fairy, and make a big pedal-shaped thing that would create additional drag, and then would fold up once you're actually doing the vertical descent to the surface. So there are a number of alternate methods. I guess the biggest thing of interest right now is in about 6 months or so, we should get, hopefully, the great revelation of what Musk's Mars architecture is. So the one I worked on starting back in 2010 now, we've been working on it for 5 years, coming up in about 4 months, is called Access to Mars, which uses a conical Apollo capsule-shaped fairy, simply because it's structurally more efficient in terms of mass, having a cone, and you know that cones are relatively stable as they're re-entering, and a cone doesn't tend to tip over very easily when it's landing compared to a pencil. And the cone provides a wide area to the air column as it's entering, and you can cover that bottom surface with material like Pika X, your thermal protective material, and it doesn't, it presents the widest possible surface compared to its volume and mass to the air, so it slows down the best. Now, I have seen one additional paper that wants to go back to the sphere cone type, the method that they use for a lot of the unmanned vehicles, which is basically almost like a flat saucer-shaped thing. But generally in those, the shields are heat shields are expendable, and you throw them away after you're through the entry process. And it would be somewhat harder to incorporate them into a fully reusable vehicle. If you're going to be sending hundreds of thousands of people to Mars, the economics of expendable vehicles, not only would you be littering Mars with hundreds of thousands of expended vehicles, which would be junk as soon as they land, but it's expensive to continuously build new vehicles when the vehicles can be used over and over again. If you think about it, all these expendable landers that they want to land on Mars almost all exclusively use totally expendable designs until very, very recently, where I'm starting to see a few people talking about reusable designs, because I've been talking about it for 20 years, and my paper started to talk about it in 2011with the reusable design. So it's just not fiscally feasible to do it. But if you look at such a vehicle at land, it has a fuel tank, propellant tank, or maybe two propellant tanks, one for the oxidizer, one for the fuel. It has a structure, vehicle structure metal. It has landing legs. It has rocket engines. It has controls. It has a cabin. It has basically everything you need. So you throw it away, and you have another vehicle that goes back into orbit. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. The one tricky part, of course, is that because all the vehicles that have gone to Mars so far have not been able to store cryogenic propellant, the vehicles so far have not been able to carry enough propellant down to the surface with them to go back into orbit. So that's why you need another vehicle to go back into orbit with. It didn't carry anything except an empty vehicle. So the solution to that, of course, is the propellant depot. If a propellant depot storing cryogenic propellants can operate in Earth orbit, or if it can operate at L1 near the moon, it can also be taken to Mars, because when it's in transit between Earth and Mars, the only heat source it has to worry about really is the sun. So if it just aims its bottom away from the sun, it has a sun shield and super insulation and cryogenic coolers, which are just basically refrigerator units powered by solar panels that keep the propellant cold. It would have several of them as backups. You're not going to lose any propellant. It'll stay at cryogenic temperatures all the way to Mars. So then you can use that propellant to land, which gives you a massive advantage. And then when you land, let's assume you're starting with a base. So when you land on Mars, your vehicles basically are empty. You can't take off again. But you've brought down with each ferry, this is of course my access to Mars design, with each ferry designed to build a base. The ferry is 30 tons, the propellant is 15 tons, but the cargo is 25 tons. So with the first seven cargo ferries, you brought down 175 tons of equipment to the surface. Now with that 175 tons, primarily it's composed of the equipment to produce propellant, cryogenic oxygen and hydrogen, store it in tanks to keep it from boiling off, and being able to transport it over to the landing site couple miles away for safety reasons, and pump it back into the ferry so the ferry can take off back into orbit and bring down another 25-ton load immediately. Or it could be a crew ferry. They can bring down a 5-ton crew cabin with crew members and a 20-ton cargo load and then go back into orbit. So my system is set up to produce 100 tons of propellant with a 5% margin once a month, which means once a month you can take another trip back up into orbit and bring down another 20 or 25 tons of cargo. So the system is set up by the end of your stay on Mars, which typically is 400 to 500 days, depending how much time you spend in orbit preparing to come down, and how much time you want to spend in orbit getting ready to leave again. You can bring down over 600 tons of equipment. So the basic story we're trying to talk here is we're not talking about a minimalist architecture. If you're talking about a base or you're talking about a colony, you're talking about, I call them, a high-mass space operation, which means that any company or country should be able to put several thousand tons minimum into orbit in 1 year before you even consider building Mars bases or Mars colonies. So that, maybe I should let you get some questions in.
What if the people don't want to return? How does that change your mission?
Well, first of all, this no return business to me is a defeatist attitude, because it implies that it is so difficult to go back and forth between Earth and Mars that it's simply physically or fiscally impossible to bring the people back. I prefer, if you have a high mass operation, first of all, you're going to need crew members, presumably the pilot and co-pilot and so forth, to shepherd the vehicles back to the Earth so they can be reused to bring the next bunch of crew members and cargo to Mars. So a certain number of people will almost certainly go back to Earth, because while some of the vehicles can be sent basically as robot spacecraft, the passenger vehicles probably would want to have at least a minimal crew when they go back. So I don't think this is not a problem. If you simply allow people to decide whether in advance or once they're there, or if they need to go back for, say, a medical, longer term medical reason, there's no reason they can get back. You can get back to Earth in about 8 months, the same as you can get to Mars in about 8 months.
Don't you have to wait for Mars to be in the right position with Earth, with this once every 2 years?
Yeah. So your typical, I guess it's called a conjunction mission,
right,
is 8 months to Mars, and then a 500-day stay on Mars, which is more than a year. And then when things line up again, then you another 8 months to get back to Mars. Now, I think they call it the opposition mission. I sometimes get those confused, but that usually involves swinging past Venus to get back to Earth faster. It uses more propellant, and you only get to stay on Mars for like 30 days, which basically means you have almost no time to do anything on the surface before you have to be back in orbit. Which, and you can't do any, you can't build a base in 30 days. It's ridiculous. So the conjunction missions are, as I remember, if that's the correct name, the best bet to do serious Mars exploration and base development.
You have a caller on hold, so let's take your call, okay? Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Doug from Southern California.
Good morning, Doc. How are you?
Good morning. Hey, John. How are you doing?
How you doing?
Welcome back to the show. Good to have you. I may have misunderstood or sort of missed it. How many people are you talking about going to Mars?
Well, my crew basically, remember, it's a total expedition for mine currently. It's a 4,000 tons dry, using about less than 2,000 tons of propellant to leave. And that is a crew of 12 with three crew modules, or I call them crew clusters because they're heavily shielded against radiation. So you would have six crew members per cluster. And then I assume that each crew ferry could bring down at least three crew members from Mars orbit down to the surface.
But earlier you were talking about hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, yeah, if we're talking about a colony, see, one of the things people forget about is that with the Apollo mission model, you're basically talking about a single vehicle with a crew in it that goes somewhere and it comes back, and you don't need cargo vehicles. But once you talk about, they almost tried to do that with Apollo, where they had the cargo, some of the cargo attached to the outside of the lunar module, but there's a limit to that with the lunar rovers. Things like that. They had no habitat or anything in the moon. The only habitat they had was the lunar lander. There was no refuge. And if that lunar lander took off and the engine failed that my dad's company built, they would have crashed back onto the moon. So there was no safety factor built into it at all. You couldn't survive there for more than a couple of days. And you had to take off. And if your engine failed, you were dead because parachutes don't work in the moon. So that's an example of an Apollo mission model mission. Now, if you do a base, I'm estimating you need 5 to 10 times more cargo payloads than you need crew payloads. So that's why we have a lot of cargo capability. There's seven cargo ferries to take stuff down to the surface, and only three crew ferries. But the cargo ferries would make repeated trips, where the crew ferries would make only a few trips up and down. And then for the same logic, you also have going from Earth orbit to Mars orbit, multiple vehicles carrying cargo as well as crew to provide all that cargo to go down to the surface. And then if you're going to do a colony, then I'm estimating you need at least 50 cargo missions for every crew carrying or passenger carrying mission of the same mass. Say if you have a vehicle that carries 100 passengers, you make at least 50 vehicles of the same size carrying cargo. Now that's to set the colony up. So here, this where it gets interesting. So as you build up a colony, you have enough physical people to operate machinery and get things built. You will gradually reach a point where you will be able to start using the equipment that can be delivered from the Earth, already to use, that requires a minimum of crew time to run it, and start fabricating stuff from local Mars materials rather than everything brought from the Earth. But even the equipment to do the fabrication would initially be brought from the Earth, just as all of your initial pressurized habitat modules would be brought from the Earth, so that you can see over a period of years and decades a transition phase, whereas the technology got better and as the number of people on Mars grew, you would gradually be able to transition to being able to build everything on Mars, other than, obviously, like if you didn't have copper deposits on Mars, you'd have to bring copper and stuff from the Earth. But we will gradually be able to find out what kind of minerals we can find on Mars.
So, John, it was that question about ISRU that I was wanting to get at. Are you? I have this question, but I have an immediate follow-up question. So, would you be producing a spent propellant from the Martian atmosphere? Would you imagine producing that propellant prior to the arrival of crew?
Well, see, if you go with the old Mars, Mars Direct, that Zubrin came up with.
Zubrin. Mars Direct.
He uses the atmosphere primarily, in the old version, he brought a tank of hydrogen along to use to make the methane. And, of course, the oxygen you get out of the atmosphere, because you've got the CO2, you just pump it up, concentrate it in a tank, and you can make carbon from that and react it with hydrogen to make methane, and it gives you the oxygen. And so you can make oxygen and methane propellants. But the problem is when you use those propellants, you get about one-third the cargo that you get with oxygen, hydrogen. You can still get your vehicle back into orbit, but without having a much greater engineering advance. My vehicle, because I'm not a structural engineer, I'm not an engineer at all, I'm a generalist, so we're very strict at listening to the other engineers. So our ascent vehicle, the ferry, when it takes off, is 20%, 4% dry mass, to make sure it's strong enough to take off over and over again. But if you use the same design with the methane, you get, instead of, say, 20 tons cargo or 20 tons back to orbit, you get about 7 tons. So it doesn't give you enough propellant to land again once you take off.
So John?
That's the problem with the methane. So we use the water ice and turn it directly into oxygen and hydrogen, which lets you take off again with a full payload of propellant.
So, how early in your concept would you be producing ascent propellant from liquid hydrogen and oxygen from local ice? How early on?
That's the first thing you do. You don't bring a single crew member down and to set up your propellant plant. Obviously, have to be able to unload the cargo, so there would be like an unloading system, probably like a truck. It could double as a tanker truck with a tank on it. And then there would be robots that would assemble. But a lot of this plant would be a package plant, so all the robots really have to do is connect the pipes together and make sure that everything is properly insulated. And the robots can be run by the crew in orbit directly, teleoperated. So they don't have to be as smart as Hal to do the job.
So, John?
Yeah.
So my question is if you are going to be producing propellant quantities from local resources.
100 tons of propellant per month from local Mars ice, which means that you need to know before you pick your landing site that the ice is actually there and close enough to the surface so that you can strip mine it with your excavator, which is going to also do the job of burying your habitats. So you can use the excavator for multiple purposes. Having multiple purpose tools is very, very efficient. And, yes, that's the very first thing you do.
So, John, my question is if you are able to produce, even before crew arrives, if you're able to produce 100 tons of propellant, so my question is why couldn't you produce 100 tons of water? Why couldn't you produce the oxygen? Why couldn't you produce the plant food against the plants? In other words, why do you need to bring so much cargo for each crew member? Why not start living off land very early and hence bring more people and less cargo?
First of all, it's crew safety. You don't want to land a single crew member until you have enough propellant stored in tanks with multiple cryo coolers keeping it cold, so that when the crew lands with its crew ferry, then you know that that crew can take off again. So then you would want to have probably a minimum of 200 tons of propellant stored. Yes, you're going to produce water. Obviously, as you melt the ice and purify it so the crew can use it. You would have probably the next thing after the propellant production is to send down habitat on one of the ferries. There, a habitat can be a four and a half by 8 meters long cylinder, and you bury the habitat under the regolith so the crew has basically minimal exposure to space radiation. You don't put your habitat on top like the tuna can method where the crew is basically being irradiated all the time.
John, why not a much bigger inflatable habitat for the same mass?
Well, I mean, that's fine, but that's just a different way of doing it. I know that Doug has an interesting concept for a pancake-shaped inflatable habitat. But, yeah, the first fuel production is first, the habitat is second. And once your habitat is buried and you have access to it, then the crew lands, and then the crew can start helping the robots do additional things. Yes, and you can expand your base pretty rapidly. The base with 600 tons of equipment probably would include additional habitat. One of the habitat modules probably could be used for food production to reduce the total mass and to provide the crew with fresh food. It all depends.
Right.
You can add additional cargo carriers to your expedition. Each one would carry roughly 200 tons of cargo, which would mean it would take 8 more months to bring that cargo down, so you would need to increase your fuel production per month, and you would probably need additional cargo ferries to bring it all down. But that could be done. You'd need a 20 megawatt reactor to produce your propellant instead of only a 10 megawatt one. But you could do that. Nobody's. All this is a baseline, but you can't do it. What I'm trying to do is, what's the minimum safe expedition that you could do that lets the crew, once the crew reach the surface, actually do something, like proving that an exploration base site is good enough for a settlement site. So they would then be able to go around and do actual drilling and prove that the ice deposit is large enough to support a settlement where you'd need millions of tons of ice, not just a few thousand tons of ice and so forth. That would be able to verify that there are mineral deposits nearby that would be able to support the base. So we now have, with the help of an engineer in Australia that I've been conversing with over the last few weeks, a design for a means of producing iron and steel on Mars. That is, once you have enough people at your colony or base to do the work. You can't, when you initially start up, you're going to have a manpower shortage, because if you think of all the different things that people have to do, there's just thousands of different jobs. And even if people have multiple skills and can do multiple jobs, you're initially going to start with a manpower shortage. But eventually, you get to the point where you won't have as much of a shortage, and then the base or colony can start expanding. And then eventually the next step is to bring the metal production and ore production equipment from the Earth, set that up so that you can then have another package plant that produces iron and steel. And if that plant can be set up so to take the steel and turn it into sheet steel, you can then produce habitats with it. Now, I would assume the really complicated parts of the habitat, such as the hatches and airlocks, probably would be shipped from Earth for several decades before you had the capability of producing an airlock on Mars. But just the overall bulk structure, I think, can be produced on Mars probably within 20 years of the first permanent base.
Go ahead,
John.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I've been on long enough. Let me go ahead and clear up the line for somebody else.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break in just a few minutes. We're almost halfway through, but I have an email question that came in a few minutes ago from Joshua, who is in Denver, Colorado. And he says, what are the economic drivers or other really important drivers for this Mars colony?
Okay, there's very clear that there's no immediate economic production value that we know of currently for trade between Earth and Mars. The main purpose of a Mars colony, first of all, is people who want to be settlers. They want to go to a new area and have the excitement and exercise their skills at living in a new place. This is what a lot of people want to do. They want to try to be a colonist, to be a pioneer. Look at all of our American pioneers that settled the barren wastelands. So it's basically the same idea. So there's no product that I can see that would be particularly useful on Earth that could be produced on Mars, other than, say, when you have enough people, you can have software produced on Mars. You know, there could be you could produce entertainment just like you'd produce on Earth, things that don't require a lot of mass. In other words, information. Would be something that could be produced. But the other main thing is the preservation of the human race and Earth's biosphere. Now, right now, of course, Mars is not a very good place for a biosphere because it's on the surface is sterile. It's basically a near vacuum, even though it has sand, there's enough air to make sand dunes and dust devils and so on. The substantial atmosphere, but physiologically it's a near vacuum. You have to wear a spacesuit. But in the long run, of course, we know that there's an almost certain chance that we can terraform Mars and make it into a habitable planet, and that would take hundreds of years probably. But look at the hundreds of years it takes to build some, look like a cathedral. Some cathedrals took hundreds of years to build. Building things that take a long time for mankind is nothing new. So, and do you have any other questions about economics?
I'm sure we'll get some, but we're going to take a break. We're halfway through the program. So, listeners, sit tight. We'll come back with the second half of our program in about 3 minutes. And if you want to call in, we do take calls during the break, and we'll hold you on the line. That number is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program, and our guest today, John Strickland. And we have two sponsors bringing us this portion of the show, the Integrated Space Plan, which is the highly detailed development chart showing paths to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see technologies and destinations build upon each other, explore hundreds of individual elements. Just go to thespaceplan, all one word, .com. They have discussions, regular updates, and exclusive interactive features. You can even order your own full-color poster. It comes in one of two sizes. So, again, check them out at thespaceplan.com. And then Celestis also is bringing you this portion of our show. Remember that Dr. Gerard O'Neill, in many ways, was the father of modern new space and commercial space movement. He was a Princeton physics professor who sparked a revolution by asking students way back in 1969 the simple question, is a planetary surface the right location for an expanding technological civilization? He later was on President Reagan's National Commission on Space. He's inspired many pro-space leaders and movements around the world, including the founders of Celestis, who were honored to include his remains aboard their founder's flight, the world's first memorial space flight in 1997. Hey, John, given that I just read this commercial spot for Celestis, a company I really love, do you think we should be having O'Neill colonies and settling space in orbit before going to Mars?
Absolutely. The both kinds of colonies should be built as soon as they're physically and fiscally possible. I believe that space colonies will eventually be built by developers who are basically creating real estate by creating the colony and then selling that real estate to people who want to live there, because you can obviously have Earth gravity inside a space colony, and it'd be actually a very exciting place to live in. So, but we don't know in the long term which is the better or safer type of colony to live in. We don't know completely about the effects of the lower gravity on Mars. It's 38% gravity. I suspect that medical advances will enable us to deal with those, certainly by the time that we're ready to create colonies on Mars. But we don't know that for sure yet. So, yes, until we have a better idea of which kind of colony is the best kind, we should build both kinds, and I tend to look at it as perhaps that in say 1,000 years from now, that the majority of living space in the solar system might be in space artificial habitat colonies, rotating colonies, and then the planets would be sort of jewels where they would be primarily like giant parks where people would visit in a completely natural environment. But there would also be natural environments that would be set up in some of the rotating colonies by groups that want to preserve animals and habitats, where there wouldn't be any poachers to shoot the animals, as an example. So there's multiple uses. And I have a whole done a lot of work on how you actually physically build, for example, a Stanford Torus or an O'Neill cylinder. So that's another very, very interesting topic we may be able to talk about at some point.
Okay, you have another email before we go to some other topics from Bijan, who is in Sweden. What do you think about starting interplanetary exploration with a human mission to the moons of Mars without landing on Mars itself? We will have to visit Mars moon sooner or later anyway, and since they are easier to reach, they seem to be the obvious first target when we go beyond Earth's moon.
Well, the main purpose to do an orbit-only mission, yes, we definitely want to find out what those moons are made of, because they could be a source of materials, but to use them means you have to develop a microgravity smelting technology to use materials from them, or you'd have to have some kind of a rotating smelter nearby. But the main reason, early reason, for doing an orbit mission, which almost certainly include visiting the moons, or perhaps you putting your habitat on one to provide radiation shielding for your habitat, is that you want to help use that mission time to find good landing sites for your exploration bases. the rovers can only do so much because they're only controlled from the Earth, which is 20 to 40 minutes away in terms of transmission time. So your response time is really slow. By the time you see an interesting rock that your rover may, that the scientists would like to see, it might be 100 feet behind you, especially once we get faster rovers. So having astronauts cruise in orbit, say with a larger crew, where you could operate, say, multiple rovers and have the rovers landed at pre-crew arrival at multiple potential human landing sites, at least one rover at each site, and then have those rovers operated by several crew members direct in real time so they can actually drive and examine rocks and make real-time decisions with geologists looking over their shoulders, would greatly speed up the ability to prove what we call ground truth, that yes, we do have an ice deposit, we do have minerals there, we do have things of scientific interest there, and so forth and so on, with the rovers being the direct extension of humans. So that's an absolutely valid reason. Plus, of course, the geological interest of the moons themselves, because we really still don't know what they are and how they got there.
Okay. I have another email for you, and I'm going to take over this question, but let me tell you about Jack in Tucson. So Jack has a question about the House Science Committee hearings yesterday with Eileen Collins, Mike Griffin, and somebody from the GAO. I forget her name. Now, I watched the 2-hour and 15-minute video on YouTube, listeners, and so I know what Jack is talking about. And Jack is talking about Mike Griffin's response to a question on when we might be ready to do human spaceflight to Mars. So that most of the hearing was about human spaceflight to Mars. So rather than using Jack words, let me tell you what Mike said when he was asked this question, because this is what Jack wants you to comment on. It was, when would we be ready for humans to go to Mars? So he said, get humans to live on, just don't interrupt me, let me tell you what it is, because it's complicated and it's going to be a little longer than I would like to use to monopolize the conversation. He said, Mike said that the first step would be to prove out humans living on the space station for 6 months without any support whatsoever or any supplies or anything from Earth. All they would have on the station was what was sent with them and what might have been pre-positioned on the station. At the conclusion of that 6 months, they take off the space station and they go to the moon. And they live on the moon, I think he said, for, don't quote me on this, for around a year or a little bit more than a year, again, without zero support from Earth. That they have to live with what they can do on the moon, with what they bring with them, and their environmental systems have to be totally closed loop. At the end of their period on the moon, they return to the space station for another period of 6 months, again, with zero support. Now, they can be in communication with Earth, but zero support, that their life support, their closed-loop systems have to be taking care of them in all aspects of this, so that by the time they finish this station to the moon, back to the station, and then ultimately come back to Earth to see how they did, to see what their health is like and check them out, they have pretty much been in space in a closed-loop environment without any support from Earth for about 3 years, give or take, which would be kind of about what a round trip to Mars would represent. And he said, when we are able to do that and bring our astronauts back from the station and they're safe, they're healthy, and we've been able to prove all of this out in our technology and our closed-loop systems, then I would say we're ready to go to Mars.
Okay, a lot of this has to do with two main issues. One, well, it's more than that, but one is the radiation protection. So, because I don't know whether he's intending to have them sit on the surface of the moon exposed to half of the interstellar.
I doubt it, because he's talking about bringing them back safely
right,
and
right.
doing
so
it. So
moon,
he's got to be shielding them somehow.
So such a system is not completely unreasonable if you work it into so that they're actually doing something productive. So we support, myself and other people, support what we know as a cislunar a method or initiative, which consists of building a system that allows you to operate in Earth orbit around the moon and on the lunar surface, but at the same time those vehicles would be immediately extendable to allow a Mars mission. And there's a difference between what you call an all-up type design and a step-by-step design. Apollo was done, ignoring the fact that it was all expendable, and it's Apollo mission model, which is almost 50 years out of date, but it was done all up, which means all the parts were built simultaneously, so they all were all ready to go in 1968-1969. But a step-by-step method would mean you build the Saturn V, and then when that was flying, you'd start work on the Apollo model capsule, and when that was working, you'd start work on the lander, and at that point, we might still not be on the moon. So if you do things all up, but not using an Apollo mission model where you're providing habitat and equipment, and you're building permanent installations at multiple locations in space, near the moon and on the moon, they can physically do things like producing propellant. So the crew would be there proving out that they can stay there, but at the same time they would be doing useful practical work such as developing a lunar mining base. So if they can combine these things, there's absolutely no problem with that. But the people who want to do a step-by-step where the program only has one function, which is a sterile, just like putting the people in a Mars chamber for 3 years or something like that, and then having them come out of the chamber and having produced no useful work, that would be wrong.
So my take on his answer was that, first of all, what they do on the station or what they do on the moon was not really relevant to the question that was asked. The question that was asked was, when would we be ready to safely go to Mars and come back? So he outlined his concept of what it would take us to be able to do to be ready, which is really handle closed-loop life support. And he laid out that kind of timeline and station, moon, station, in order to prove out that closed-loop was viable without any support from Earth. I'm assuming they have functions to do on the station and on the moon, although you never know anymore with government, by making assumptions. But I'm assuming they're not going there to listen to sports games on shortwave radio coming into the moon or to read comic books or something, that they are going to be doing something that is productive. And since this is to prove out that they're ready to go to Mars, I think that it would also, they would probably have them doing things that in some ways, trained them for or got them ready for the Mars mission. But Mike has agreed to come on the space show on March 22nd. So this will be his third or fourth or fifth visit, I don't know what. And for those of you that are interested and want to ask him about this, we can find out what he has them doing during this period of 6 months at the station and going to the moon and then coming back while they're testing out closed-loop life support. We'll find out. I mean, it wasn't part of the question. It wasn't part of the focus, on as far as I could tell from the congressional hearings.
So a lot of the problem is that a lot of these plans depend on what I refer to as minimalist architectures, which are based on the fact that we do not currently have the ability to support high-mass space operations. And so our missions are in the order of 10 tons to a few hundred tons, like the space station, which took a whole decade to get its 500 tons in orbit. So within 5 to 10 years, we will be in the era of high-mass space operations before we would be beginning any human Mars operations. So the issue is less of resupply, because you would have to be able to have multiple backup copies of equipment and food and water and tools and materials to repair tools like with 3D printers, which can produce duplicate tools and equipment. So the main thing then becomes a physiological response. And to me, the big issue and the big issue a lot of other people talk about as to why you can't go to Mars at all is radiation. And my solution is, if you can do high-mass space operations, and my mission plan for the first expedition to Mars, which is actually does include a landing at a permanent base, is 4,000 tons dry leaving from L1, you know, going to Mars. But if you can do that, you don't have to worry as much about the equipment failures aspect. But you also have the mass available to provide shielding for the crew, so the radiation becomes much less of a problem. I use a design which includes a habitat cylinder that the crew lives in the middle while they're in space. And these could be used at L1, they could be used at the space station, anywhere it's in space, or in transit to Mars, with additional cylinders around them. And there's like a half meter of water completely surrounding the crew. Now, the water weighs over 100 tons. But if you have a mission of 4,000 tons going to Mars and hundreds of tons of cargo that you're going to take there, a few hundred tons for radiation shielding isn't that big a deal. And so once you reduce the propellant load to less than a quarter of your dry mission mass for your expedition, then taking additional mass along does not become that big a problem, and you've reduced the main problem, which is radiation.
Doug sent in another question. Then I want to change the focus of the show, but Doug's question is about the Mike Griffin statement. Mike's statement regarding demonstrating a full Martian mission is, I think, reasonable. However, I have to keep emphasizing that there are different Thursday of missions that go to Mars. However, is a Mars flyby mission a mission that goes to Mars? How about a mission that goes to Phobos or Deimos? You don't have to go to the surface of the moon to prove that can be a Mars flyby mission. So first things first, I personally think we can conduct a Mars flyby mission earlier than later. So I suggest, Doug, that March 22nd, when Mike is on the show, ask him his thoughts on a Mars flyby mission. That never came up in the congressional hearings yesterday, by the way.
So the critical thing is, by the time you're ready to do a Mars landing mission with the crew, you ask a simple question. Have you found at least one good landing site that has the resources that a Mars base will need, which includes, obviously, first of all, water, and preferably some other resources such as like something you can make metals out of, other types of minerals that you might be able to use. But the most critical thing is water ice. And we think we can find base sites within 25 degrees of the Mars equator. If you haven't found such a site yet, then you would go to the backup plan, which is an orbit only, which almost certainly would involve visits to the moon, or maybe even, as I said, using one of the moons as additional radiation shielding, because it would block 50% of your cosmic nuclei just by being next to a moon. And then you use that mission, as I described before, to help find a base site by having multiple rovers down that are teleoperated directly by the astronauts. And if you can't find a base site that way, then you're going to have to do another mission until you find one. But I'm sure with that level of competence and skill right at Mars, with a direct response of the rovers, you should be able to find a valid base site.
Another question for you by email from Randy in Berkeley. David, I'm at work. No, can use the phone. But, John, with any of your sources, are you getting even a glimpse of what Elon Musk might announce as his Mars plan?
Well, we've seen already the images and video of what is called Red Dragon, which is the Dragon capsule landing on Mars.
Right.
And I suspect with the amount of propellant that it has, perhaps somewhat augmented that a Dragon capsule with a light load could probably land on Mars using supersonic retropropulsion, because its nozzles, because they're designed for an escape operation from a failing rocket initially, can do SRP all by itself if it were entering into the Mars atmosphere. Of course, it doesn't start doing that until it's, you know, it enters at like almost 4 kilometers per second in hitting the Mars atmosphere. But most of the velocity is lost by what I refer to as passive drag. That is, the atmosphere slows the vehicle down until it's going, oh, maybe 800 meters per second. And then it's going slower and slower and starting to curve down towards the ground. Then your rocket engines kick in, and eventually you're doing a completely vertical landing. So that, you know, that's completely possible to use one of those for a Mars landing. But then if you're talking about, Musk seems to want to go very quickly towards actually taking passengers to Mars for a colony. But first you have to have a base site, which means you have to have an exploration base to prove that your base site will support a colony. And like I said, you probably want at least 1 million tons of water ice locally, not just a few thousand tons, that would support a base satisfactorily. So you need to prove the colony site out, which is a really good reason to have more than one or more exploration base sites first. Each one of those is going to be a full expedition.
Well, do you get any, like the listener said, are you getting any glimpses or advanced information or any hints of what his plan is going to consist of?
Okay, I'm not getting any information from SpaceX other than what they publicly relate. But if you think about the rumors we're starting to get of even wider Super Falcons, what some people refer to as the BFR, we're hearing ranges of diameters for the Super Falcon rocket, or some people call it the Falcon 20. It has a number of different names. It would be Saturn V size or larger, and it would take off and land itself on 100-foot-long landing legs. Some people have even talked about a Falcon, which would each core would be at least 10 meters in diameter, the size of a Saturn V. Imagine three Saturn V's taking off side by side, and then each of the cores landing independently on 100-foot landing legs. That would be a sight to see. But I expect that to happen within a decade or even less time. So if you have a wide booster, when you're using a wide lander on Mars, there's a little problem. You have to get the lander or ferry into Earth orbit before you can use it at Mars, right?
Right.
You can't wave a magic wand and put it into orbit around Mars. You have to get into Earth orbit first, which means it has to be launched on a booster. Now, the rule that we've learned by observing the development of the abortive Constellation vehicle was that you can have a stage on top of a narrower stage, and that stage can be at least 1.5 times as wide as the stage below it. So that tells me that the payload can be 1.5 times as wide as the upper stage below it. And in most of Musk rockets, all the stages are the same diameter, so they can simply make the stages, are, you know, using the same machinery. Everything's as standard as possible. So let's take a look. If you have a 10-meter wide booster, that means you can have a 15-meter wide base cone-shaped a ferry or lander. If you have a 15-meter wide booster, that means your ferry could be 22.5 meters wide, which is really getting, you know, that's like 75 feet wide. It's getting really huge. So it all depends on how big a booster he's planning on building. What I'm thinking is that Musk wants to have vehicles that can take off with, say, 50 or 100 passengers in them, and land on Mars, probably different vehicles with 50 or 100 passengers in them. They don't, you know, you're not going to be sitting in the vehicle all the way to Mars in airplane-like seats for 8 months. You're going to have a space liner to go from Earth orbit to Mars orbit, which is going to be a lot larger, more like a space station. Probably I would refer to it as a space liner, which could be built like a space station out of modules, but it still has to be much, much larger than the vehicles that, that you use to take off and land. But that, you know, everyone refers to the Mars Colonial Transport as a single vehicle. My guess is that, that the Mars Colonial Transport is either the vehicle that would land people on Mars, or it's a system of vehicles that would take people off from the Earth into orbit, take them perhaps, say, to L1, which I prefer, which but there's other orbits you can use, and then from there depart to Mars using various methods. Getting to Mars orbit, you then would probably transfer to a Mars station, or you could possibly transfer directly to the Mars lander, and then your passengers would land on Mars with that separate vehicle, and your passenger vehicle would go back to the Earth, ready to take another load of passengers to Mars as soon as the window opens. The windows to Mars open every 26 months. But that, you know, those are little clues, but we don't have anything definite. We don't have anything in black and white yet that we can point to say this is what he's going to do. So it's going to be very, very exciting to see when Musk reveals his Mars architecture, hopefully in September, so that we will have a clear vision from at least one group of engineers as to how they would do it. It's not necessarily the only way to do it. It's not necessarily the best way to do it. It's a way to do it that a group of engineers thinks is feasible and practical.
Doug has another question. I guess he's really on a roll today. I'm thinking that the presence of large amounts of water ice is the main criteria for a Martian base. Could L-Cross-like impactors be a cheap way to prove the presence of significant amounts of water ice?
I think the best way is a better radar system. The radar systems we have now are almost able to detect that. But we need a higher resolution, higher power radar that can give us the vertical resolution to tell us, one, how deep the ice is, two, how thick the layer of ice is, and three, how pure the ice is. We know that there are millions of cubic miles of water on Mars. A lot of it, of course, is around the polar caps and the higher polar latitudes, like where the Phoenix landed within a couple inches of the surface. You struck ice right there. You can see it. There's ice right up, basically right on the surface with a thin layer of the dirt on top of it. But the closer to the equator you go, the deeper the ice is going to be under the surface until at some point you will only have ice in certain areas. Typically on the north side of a hill, for example, where the sun can't heat up the ground and make the ice evaporate. So yeah, you will definitely want to find the ice. Once you find have a radar site, the best solution is a lander. If you're serious about landing at a certain site and setting up a man base, you will want to have a rover or a lander that would go over and actually drill into the ice and get what we refer to as ground truth, that is physically being there at the ground and getting a core of ice and saying, here is how deep the ice is and here is how pure it is, to verify what your radar tells you.
We're approaching the 90 minutes on the show, and I know you wanted to talk about other topics. What else did you want to address today? So let's make sure we can get it covered.
Well, there's so many things. What do we have?
Well, we don't have
about 10 minutes left.
Yeah, about 10 minutes left. We need, you know, a year to cover all your.
Well, yeah, right. We can perhaps at some point in the future cover more of this topic. For example, you're going to be producing or shipping from Earth habitats, hard shell or inflatable habitats that would be used for people, and they must be buried. Yes, you could produce water jackets on Mars for Mars ice, but it would be easier to simply bury the habitats to because the regolith is free, and you can just dump it on top of your habitat that's been put down in a trench. It's very easy for an excavator. If your excavator can excavate the ice, it can bury the habitat. But at some point, you want, if you're going to have it like a settlement, you're going to want to have larger habitat. You're also going to want to make additional habitats from local materials. So, as I mentioned, I've been talking to this mining engineer and chemical engineer in Australia, and he's explained to me a thing called the carbonyl process. Now, this is something that's specialized to chemical industrial engineers. But what it is, you take your iron ore, which can be either crushed basalt, turn into a powder, or iron oxide, like the Mars blueberries, turn into a powder. And you heat it up moderately and expose it to carbon monoxide. The carbon monoxide and the iron oxide in the ore then turn into iron or nickel, depending whether there's any nickel in the mix too, a metal carbonyl, which is actually a pale yellow liquid at room temperatures and pressures, but is in some cases somewhat or very toxic. But of course, there's no people inside the pressurized a manufacturing facility with the liquid, so no one would be poisoned by it. And you're using carbon monoxide itself, which is a poison, to make the stuff in the first place. You then take the liquid and you remove that from the chamber, and you I forget what they do, but you react that with something else, and that produces basically pure powdered iron. I guess you just heat it to drive off the carbon monoxide again, which you can then reuse, and you basically have relatively pure powdered iron. And then you may have to put it through another phase to produce even purer iron. You can then use the carbon in the Mars atmosphere to add enough carbon to the iron to make steel, but then of course to take the steel billet, at which you would obviously need to melt, and turn them into sheet steel to make a habitats out of, you need to have a rolling mill. Now, that's all going to cost a fair amount of mass, and it would all have to be shipped in parts to Mars and assembled. So a lot of this, as I say, you can't do this right away. You have to wait until you have sufficient manpower on Mars to start your expansion of your colony or settlement. But that's something that you don't need a huge amount of water to process the ore. You will need water in the industrial process itself. Then at some further point in the future, you're also going to have to consider transportation. If you can imagine a vast city of buried habitats all connected together with nothing larger, say, than 5 meters. But imagine if you just had a city neighborhood with no expressways and no buses or trolleys to get around. So this at some point starts to get impractical for a population. Musk wants to put 1 million people. Well, imagine 1 million people in a city all underground with no rail transport between one part of it or another. So how would people get to their jobs if they couldn't move around rapidly? They'd have to walk through habitat after habitat. So you're going to need larger structures, which may eventually involve domed structures that might be on the surface if they're large enough. You've got to figure out how to build those. You've got to figure out how to build larger habitats using Mars material, so you can have really large, like underground shopping malls. You would have cupolas sticking out above the surface with a thick layer of Mars regolith on top, so that people can look out at the Mars landscape and not feel trapped underground. There's all kinds of different aspects. You would be having much larger ability to grow food for such a city. I really can't get into this very much, but the general impression is that I'm getting is you need at least 1/4 to 1 acre of land to grow food for one person. Now with the growth chambers, that the area is much smaller. But then if you add animals, if you want like chickens for meat, then you almost double the required area because you also have to grow the food for your animals to grow.
We haven't really talked much about what it's going to take to actually have policies and everything to get us to Mars, but what's the timeline where we could actually begin some of what you're talking about to take us to Mars?
Okay.
How soon, and what's, say, the first one or two or three things that have to happen before we can really even start to buy the supplies for our covered wagon?
Well, unfortunately, NASA itself is simply going down, as in its administration, is simply going down the wrong path. At the current rate, NASA, we won't get to Mars until after 2040, because they keep postponing everything, and they insist on using a giant expendable rocket, the SLS, to get us there, and you can't afford that. If you're doing high-mass space operations, which require typically dozens of launches per year, you can't afford, physically, you can't do that with an SLS, because you can't afford to throw away giant rockets every week.
All right, so
you're going to have to have reusable rockets, and I assume that SpaceX, within a decade or less, will have giant reusable rockets. So that part of the problem seems to be on its way to being solved. We know it's not guaranteed, but it looks like that's going to happen. But we also have to develop the infrastructure in what we call the cislunar transportation system and infrastructure that gives us a base at L1 from which you can more practically launch your missions to Mars. That's really key to being able to get to Mars and back again inexpensively and safely.
So are you saying 10 years or what?
I would say at Musk's current rate, at least in the ability to put crew members for a Mars an exploration base, which I assume he would do before he attempts to set up a city, I assume that would be possible certainly within the 2020 range, possibly as early as 2025 if he really pushes it. But certainly between 2025 and 2030, that Musk probably would be able to set up exploration bases on Mars to prove out that they would be able to support a settlement. And then sometime after 2030, Musk would be able to set up and start expanding a settlement. Because he is much more aggressive than NASA because he's using the right methods to do it, and it will be able to support high-mass space operations very rapidly.
So you're seeing Musk as the path to Mars.
Yeah, but that's going to set up what I refer to as the coming clash over Mars, because a lot of the people in space science regard humans as giant bags of bacteria, which will contaminate Mars, and then they claim we will never be able to tell whether Mars had indigenous life on it. Well, in actuality, the surface of Mars is a giant ultraviolet baking system, which pretty much sterilizes everything that's on the surface that's exposed to the UV. So as long as you don't drill all over the Mars down into the and get ice out of it, you restrict that to just a few locations, then you'll be able to go to other areas, which the surface will probably still be pretty sterile because of the ultraviolet flux from the sun and the radiation in the vacuum, and drill down into Mars at other locations using human crews to do the drilling. I don't think robots will be able to drill a couple miles deep. You tell a crew of roughnecks in Texas if they think that a robot drill team could drill 2 miles deep and bring back samples, I think they'd laugh.
Yeah. We're about out of time, but are you optimistic that, so you're basically saying probably the earliest we're going to get there is 2025, 2030 range.
2025, I can see that Musk could get a crew if he has a rocket right after 2020, if he has a big rocket and takes, say, 2 or 3 years to prove that the big rocket is safe and can be reliably landed. And by that time, of course, his landing technology will have evolved even further. It's just a matter of scaling it up. And then giving him the time to build the Mars vehicle. Now, he hasn't actually started building any Mars vehicles yet because he's still developing his plans. But given 10 years from now, let's say to 2026, that would be a full 10 decade, to start designing and building his Mars vehicles, I would say that he could put a crew on Mars by the mid 2020s. Now, that assumes, I assume he's going to do that.
You have one final email, and listeners, this is it, because we wouldn't need to bring the show to a close, unfortunately. This is Helen in Seattle, and Helen says, to go to Mars in 2025, there is an assumption being made that not only will the technologies that are needed will be in place, but also the closed-loop environmental and the astronaut safety for human factors will be in place, or at least so far along in mitigation that it would be safe to send a crew to Mars by 2025. Do you really think that that's enough time for all of this to fall into place,
excluding radiation? A lot of that stuff about astronaut survival has more to do with failure of equipment and running out of food or having your food vehicle damaged and so forth, because they're still thinking about minimalist Mars missions. But if you have a maximalist mission, which is what are referred to as a robust mission with lots and lots of duplicates of food and supplies and equipment and tools and vehicles, your chances of losing your crew are really low. The current missions that are based on the Mars design reference missions, like the current one, the last one was 5.0 in 2009, and some of the more recent outgrowths of that, cause a very high risk of losing the crew on every single mission, because you only have one vehicle, and if that one vehicle fails, the crew is dead. There's no backup.
Yeah, but she's talking about the medical issues that are not necessarily related to having a redundant crew vehicle or redundancy. She wants to know, are the gravity problems, the vision problems, the blood circulation, the cardiac problems, the 37 human medical risk for long-duration spaceflight, are they going to be substantially mitigated by 2025, or will Musk or whoever does this cast their fate to the wind and say, to hell with it, we're going anyway, and okay, we'll probably be okay?
While you're in transit to Mars, you're obviously in microgravity, unless you put your crews into a rotation with two crew clusters rotating about each other, so they're protected from radiation, and if you rotate two crew clusters around each other, you can provide, you know, if you want to, a full Earth gravity. So that gets rid of most of the space medicine problems by simply having the mass to get rid of them. So that, you know, if we have the budget, it would be advisable to set up such rotating environments in Earth orbit or near the Earth to test them out and see how they work. Yeah, but I think all these things should be taken very seriously. But if the government doesn't do that, at some point the private companies are going to come along, and assuming they have the budget to do it, they will do it independently of the government. At some point, you know, I'm afraid NASA will be left in the dust, and then there'll be a big bureaucratic struggle over, can you land on Mars without NASA's permission, for example? This is going to be very interesting to see what happens. Will SpaceX have to have a court order? Will they go to the Supreme Court as to whether they can land on Mars without NASA's permission? This is going to be, you know, very, very interesting.
Summarize us up for the show real quick. We gotta close down. What would be your concluding comments and talking points? So when you come back on for the third time next month, we'll try to see if we can, you know, make it into a two-hour program on my end.
Yeah, well, think of this. The crux is to have large reusable rockets, and you can use the medium-sized ones like the current Falcons, that are reliable and can land again and can be used over and over again, so the cost comes way down. And with high mass capability, if you have the high mass, you can then do an all-up mission design and set up so you can do lunar missions, cislunar missions, and Mars missions all within a few years of each other, because all the equipment, much of that equipment, is very, very similar.
Okay. What's the topic of your next appearance on the program next month?
I had it written down. One of the possibilities was to talk about what you mentioned earlier, is the construction of space colonies, how you physically build one. But we could also continue the discussion, if you want, of Mars colonies, because there are so many questions about the near term, how you get to Mars and how you first set up a base, that we really didn't get into the actual construction of the colonies very, very much.
Okay.
We can do either one. Or
maybe try to get both in. All right. So we'll try to make the next one you're on my end, at least, if you can do it, a two-hour program, so we won't be quite as rushed as today.
That's fine.
Okay. And good luck. Happy voting coming up on Tuesday for you.
Oh, yeah. I'll be there at the polls.
And may your person win, whoever that person may be. So good luck with your success. I guess it'll be interesting for the rest of us to see what happens in Texas. And thanks for sharing your time with us this morning. And we will look forward to your next broadcast with us. I forget what day it is in March, but it's a couple of weeks down the road. And everybody have a great weekend. We're coming up on the weekend, and this is last weekend of February. Can you believe how fast time is going? So thank you all for listening, participating, your emails and phone call. And keep looking up. And by the way, Open Lines is on Sunday. So make sure you call in. Let us know what's on your mind. Goodbye from the Space Show and from John Strickland.